Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Sunny La.
Kwe.
Why eat beef snack seal?
Tan She.
Tanet E. Negar Dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tanashi Kia, Sheila Rogers Dishini Kashun, and Michif Nia. My name is Sheila Rogers, and I'm Métis. And by the way, hello. I'm honored to be your host for Words and Culture, the Michif episodes. I've chosen to live in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 territory, Winnipeg Niwikin, and it's also the homeland of the Red River Métis. This urge to live here fed a strong need to connect with family and ancestors. Growing up, I didn't know that my father and his family were Métis, but throughout my childhood, he would say, "We have a touch of smoke in the family." He never explained it, just chuckled when asked about it. And I ended up thinking that we came from a long line of smokers. It wasn't until 2 years after he died that I began to understand what he might have meant. There was a family tree that included a woman named Nahue Sinclair. I started researching her, and that led me to meeting descendants of Nahue and her husband, William Sinclair. I've connected with cousins and visited the resting places of ancestors. They were all linked to the fur trade, and they lived and worked in what is now Winnipeg and also Norway House and Fort York. It's a powerful feeling to walk where they walked and spend time by the river they paddled, in York boats probably, stuffed to the gunwales with supplies or furs. My guest today is also on a journey of reconnection. Though she grew up knowing about her heritage, her last 20 years of finding family have been a journey of discovery and reconnection to her ancestors, who are also from Treaty 1 territory. She's connecting to them and their stories through song. On this installment of the Michif episodes for Words and Culture, I sit down with the Métis singer-songwriter Amanda Rayom. I caught up with Amanda at the West End Cultural Center in Winnipeg, where she was passing through on tour for a new album called The Truth We Hold. That album came about from Amanda collecting undocumented stories from Métis communities. When I met up with her, she and her sound people were setting up the stage for her live show that night. And here is our conversation.
Hi, I'm Amanda Rayom. I'm a citizen of the Métis Nation of Ontario. My Métis relatives and ancestors are from Treaty 1, Red River, last name Bannatyne. And I also have Anishinaabe relatives from Lac Seul, northwestern Ontario. Actually just met a bunch of cousins I never met like over a year ago now. And I have mixed settler ancestry and relatives. I was born on unceded Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory. My grandpa, Jean Rayom, moved there because he was in politics and we just never left. And I pay rent in Toronto.
Have you always known your Métis?
I didn't know that that's what it was called, like, for a long time. I just knew who my family was and knew who my grandpa was. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about it like that. Like, what are we?
Yeah.
So I would say that, you know, as time went on and I was meeting more and more family across the country and just learning more and more things about our family story, like specifically my great-grandma, so my grandpa's mom. My great grandma's name was Stella Rayom, and she was, well, Stella Bannatyne, and then she became a Rayom, but she was born in and around Lac Seul, but was sent to Winnipeg when she was two, like away from her brothers and her mom, and actually lived with Annie Bannatyne, who is her grandma. I know, so funny.
Should talk about Annie Bannatyne, because if you're connected to Annie Bannatyne, mm-hmm. you've got
some fire.
Fire, I was going to say cojones.
Oh, yeah.
She would not take any merit,
No, this is as the story goes. Yeah, I was excited to learn that story about Thomas Mayer and how she dealt with his derogatory comments.
With a whip.
With a whip, yeah.
And you made it into a song.
I did. Yeah. I actually wrote it with Shoshona and Raven.
Like just pulling out a horsewhip,
yeah,
because you're insulting half-breed women.
Yeah, I mean, he printed it in the Toronto Globe, and I guess the paper found its way to her kitchen table, and so she took matters into her own hands. And I think that like the men are talked about a lot, you know, which is also awesome. There's great men; everyone knows like the main, like Louis Riel and Gabriel Dumont and all that. But I just think. And obviously more than that, but I think that lifting up the women and what the women were managing and doing to keep the families going and help the men when they were in the battle, all that stuff, I just think it's time to talk about that.
I think you're absolutely right. And unearthing all these stories, you've got 10, 11 brand new stories mm-hmm. on this album. What drew you to those stories?
I wanted to try to write songs inspired by stories from across the homelands, not just one place. I feel excited to have that opportunity, and like it's an honor, and I feel a great sense of responsibility to, lift up as many kind of, as I'm allowed to, you know, try to make sure, I've made sure that people are okay with me telling in these stories and singing them, But these were just the sort of the ones that kind of wrote themselves in a way.
So when you have the stories and you're holding them, what kind of responsibility do you feel towards the story and the storyteller?
Well, I feel a great responsibility to make sure whoever's involved in the story, if that will become a song, that they know, you know, and they're okay with it. And that process, like I have a song number 44 that is about a man named Robert Morasti, who's a residential school survivor from Isle of Cross Residential School that only just recently got recognized as a residential school, which is crazy. And I told him I was very inspired by an interview I heard of his, and I said we were just texting. I'd never met him yet, and I said I'd really like to write a song. What do you think about that? And I said I'll send you the song in a voice note before I actually record it. And then if you're okay with it, then I'll record it. So I just... very important to do that in that way. And then I did write all these songs actually with songwriter friends because I really wanted to do the stories and the songs justice and do a good job, you know, as best a job as we could. And I think that there's just a lot of misinformation, even disinformation about Métis people. Because a lot of these songs are not my own story, I felt it was very important to do it in a good way.
You also have a couple of fiddle tunes mm-hmm. on the album. Why was that important to you?
Well, fiddle's such a, important aspect to Métis culture and like songs, of course, and dance, and really like such a part of gathering. You know, like it's there's always a fiddle happening and being played and dancing. And so I think that, you know, one of the songs is a John Archon song and Distant Drum. And he's like blazed the trail for so many people. And I really just hoped to honor him and honor his legacy in that way. And just kind of give a flavor of some of these older tunes. I mean, Big John McNeil is just like a very popular song in Métis kitchen parties and communities. And then Steps of the Old Ones, Alyssa Delbar Sawchuk actually wrote, composed that song. So that's her own song.
She's your fiddle player.
Yeah.
She's really good.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah.
John Archon was legendary, right? Yeah, we got a little bit of sound happening in the background.
Okay, great.
As you're getting set up for
here
your
we
concert.
Are.
Yeah, that's so
that's
cool.
That's cool, okay.
Yeah, but just about John, did you know of him when you were growing up?
I knew of John's music, of course, but we just drove from Saskatoon to Winnipeg, and on the right before our Saskatoon show, we got to go over to John's house, and we went into his like room where all of his like 100 fiddles are like hanging, and it was the coolest thing. Yeah, we got to visit with him a bit, and that felt really special. This trip has been pretty cool so far, like full circle moments. Yeah.
Speaking of full circle, so just looking at the titles of your songs, on The Truth We Hold, I Won't Hide. Mm-hmm. And you end with Can't Make Us Gone. Mm-hmm. There's so much pride in all of the songs. But did you see it as a sort of cycle in the album?
I didn't know this was going to be the order of the songs. It kind of just worked out perfect. But I did realize there was like a thread of kind of like, I'm going to say resistance or just resilience, both of those things. In the themes, specifically, yeah, the Pauli story is I Won't Hide as such a big one for all Métis people.
Want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually called, his wife and his daughter, to ask as many questions as possible. I was like, what happened that day that they shot the moose? Well, Steve and his son, Roddy, had got a moose. They shot it. And normally they would, you know, harvest it and like cut it up and then like hide it to get it home. They were hiding it all the time. And Steve talks about all these different ways in this interview. I never met Steve. But you know, and he just said that this day he was sick of it. He was sick of hiding. And so instead he tied it to the top of his truck, like with the rack out on top of his truck, and drove down like the main drag of Sault Ste. Marie. I just like, you know, those rap videos where like the cars are bouncing, and like I just kind of imagine this like gangster Pauli truck and whatever. So they got home and
ever deadly,
right?
Yeah.
And someone called the I guess it would have been the MNR, Ministry of National Resources, I guess. Yeah. I don't know, whatever. They called somebody and they got charged, and they fought for 10 years at every level of court, and every level of court kept like appealing the decision even when they would win. So anyway, in the end they got the rights to hunt. And I think it was very symbolic because it was the first time that Métis people had been acknowledged in that way under Section 35. So it was a very big step. And made possible by the work of Harry Daniels and you know, all kinds of other people, but pretty epic.
To the man in the red coat, coming up off down the distance, keep your bullets and your cuffs upon your own. We ain't here on no procedures, we're just out here for the creatures, call their bodies on the land that we call home. Till evening, got a good is all we know. Loaded up on our black
feet. You pay a lot of respect to elders and ancestors. I'll ask you about ancestors in a minute, but sometimes you even use elders' voices, like they're actual speaking. I love that when you do that and then you pick up a song. In the song, well, the chorus is "No one's gonna tell you they burned down Agaba Bay."
Yeah.
Tell me about that song and Dolores, who starts it off.
Yeah. So, over the years, I'd go to all, you know, Métis gatherings, and one year, a friend of mine, Mitch Case, was giving a presentation on this community, like on Sault Ste. Marie and the river lots, and talking about how all that went down and the relationship between like Shingwak and the half-breeds at the time. And then he moved to this community where... It's called, well, Agaba Bay, so you might be familiar with it. If anyone's ever driven the shores of Lake Superior, you kind of drive by it and there's pictographs there and everything. But so a bunch of families from, I'll say, town, when they lost their river lots, they moved up to Agaba Bay and they made their own kind of life there. They built their own cabins and they were, you know, fishing and actually taking like tourists or like come from awayers around during the summers. And there was one family, the Busnos, and this man named Dave Busno had purchased some land from the Hudson's Bay Company, but they didn't give him the deed at the time. And they said, well, when the road goes past your house, then you'll get your deed.
I was promised by a deed when they brought in the highway line.
Anyway, he never got it, like when he was alive. And at one point, this would have been the MNR, the Ministry of Natural Resources, came in, or the Ontario government, and they said, you know, this land is going to be used for a provincial park, and it's meant to be for the enjoyment of many, not just some. So you guys are going to have to get out of here, basically. And because they couldn't find the paperwork, like, it was just like...
This is after paying for land that was already theirs.
Yeah, this was
theirs,
like in the 60s.
Right.
You know, and so they essentially called them squatters and forced them to leave, and then they burnt all their houses down.
Didn't want to do it, but I burnt it down anyway. Got orders from Toronto to burn down Agaba Bay.
And like, I didn't know that story. You couldn't even find it on the internet. Like, when I heard this presentation by Mitch, I tried to find it. This was years ago, and I was like, I can't even find this. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you can since sort of see a couple things about it, but so I wrote this song, and I wrote it with Tara Lightfoot, and we, like, it's a kind of a banger. Like, she's so great, and we sat down, and where the chorus comes from.
Can you sing it for us?
No. I don't know, maybe. But Dolores Pinder is Dave Busno's granddaughter.
Okay.
And she's the one in the interview at the video. Yeah. And she just says, I've lived my life for this place, and I'm just trying to die here one of these days. And I was like, that's only a song lyric, you know? And I made sure to ask Mitch and check with the family who's still alive, because Dolores actually passed away, not very long after the song was recorded.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, so well, I've received some messages from the family, like, and they're really happy the song exists, so.
No one's going to tell you they burned down Agaba Bay.
Yeah, no one is going to tell you. I'm just going to tell you.
Is no one going to sing it?
Yeah. Well, I was just in Australia and I had the whole audience singing along that part.
Oh,
and I was
amazing.
Like,
amazing. Because it's a sad story. Mm-hmm. It's an angering story. Mm-hmm. It's a story of wrongness. Mm-hmm. But it's really fun. The song is really fun.
Well, and it's kind of like a little trick. Like, you get people to sing it, you know, and then more people know about it. I don't know. I just think it's really fun.
There's there's a song called Flossies. Tell us about Flossies. Flossies.
Totally. So Flossie, Aunt Flossie, actually Tony Belcourt is the one that told Alyssa and I, who's the fiddler playing in my band, this story about Aunt Flossie. And whenever Tony would tell this story, his whole face would light up and he'd get lighter. And like, he was so excited to share about Aunt Flossie, because Aunt Flossie every Sunday, this is taking place in Lac St. Anne when Tony was at like a boy.
Yeah. In Alberta.
Yeah. He would talk about how every Sunday after church, the whole community would go over to Flossie's and walk down there after the Sunday church, and people, you know, would get there, and eventually like the chairs would get moved away and people would get their fiddles out and the guitars, and then all this dancing would happen and there'd be Bullets and Bang on and Bannock and like all, you know, just like a full kitchen party every Sunday. And he would talk about how he was like a little boy, so he'd sit under the chair of the guitar player and he would just like see the feet moving up and down on the floor. And
beautiful.
So I was like,
what an image. Yeah.
I really wanted to write this song for him, because it was something that brought him so much joy. I mean, the groove of the song, the way it's recorded, isn't like a Métis, you know, it's not like a traditional fiddle tune, but Alyssa wrote that fiddle line, and it kind of has like a little bit of a Big John McNeil vibe. And so that was all just to kind of create this feeling of a kitchen party, and also to honor that, you know, a community from Alberta as well.
I love that. And I think about, I saw Tony last year in Batosh jigging. Mm. And he's amazing.
I know. He still goes for it.
He's really incredible.
I know. Yeah, he's awesome.
Amanda, when you look at your albums, and this is number six?
Six.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you see them moving?
Oh, no, I don't know. I always joke, I'm like, this is the last one, you know.
But then you're finding all these stories.
I know. And, I'm like, there's so many more to tell. Yeah. I feel like I'm moving. Every record I feel really proud of, and then every, like the most recent one, I always feel like feels like the most me. So I think that's like, that happens every time. And I mean, I'm not a young person anymore. I'm not old, but I'm not young. And
talk to the hand.
Well, just saying, you know, for in the music biz, I'm in the middle, I think.
Okay, those are music years.
Yeah, music,
okay,
in the music
it.
Industry.
I have CBC years.
Yeah. So, me too, I think. Yeah. But I think I feel like I want to continue telling stories and singing songs and sharing and like connecting with people. You know, I really feel like it's an important time to come together, and I guess music is my way of hopefully doing that.
I want to ask you about language, Michif, whatever you might be learning to connect with words and culture.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, I actually started taking Anishinaabemowin courses online. There is a Assembly of Seven Generations in Ottawa that they're doing awesome work, and they were offering these courses. And so I was lucky enough to be able to start learning. It's like, it's definitely a journey, and I'm at the very beginning.
And this connects back to your family.
So because like my great grandma and like, you know, she was moved to Winnipeg and grew up like as a half breed, and like that's how her life moved forward. But she has tons of relatives and family that stayed in Lac Seul and Northwestern Ontario that are Anishinaabe. And I was like, cool. Well, there's this course, so I could learn that. And I didn't know where to find a Michif course at the time. And I mean, I have a French last name, but I am so not French. Like I'm not French, you know? So I think, I've been, you know, as I'm sort of hearing Michif words and, you know, starting to kind of learn in that way, it feels like I'm almost learning like two languages at the same time, you know?
You kind of are.
Yeah.
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 I think I just started, so like such a baby, like look at my shoes. They're just tiny little baby booties, right?
But yeah, nice shoes.
Oh, thank you very much. yours are way nicer though, just gotta say. But I was told it was like the nouns are French, and the verbs are Cree.
Okay.
But that's not always true. Like, there are just so many variations.
And, and from different places.
Yeah, exactly. Regional variety all over the place. Yeah.
Well, I was sitting with Robert Morasti the other day, who I wrote number 44 about on the record, and he's a language speaker. And we were asking him these questions about, like, what does this mean? And we were talking about the word Otipemsoak, and meaning the people that govern themselves, or, and sometimes the meaning like the free people, I guess, as well. And I, like, when I did some of those Anishinaabe Mohan classes, like, the language is so beautiful, and I'm so grateful that people have kept it alive, languages, because it changes how you think. You know, and what I've heard is that it, like, informs, you know, like, your worldview, basically. And so I feel like it's another layer of, like, decolonizing my own brain, basically, and connecting to the land, and also just, like, my ancestors, I suppose.
Do you have any words in Michif that you know yet?
I don't. No, do you?
Yeah. Oh, my. I can say bon soir.
Oh, yeah. Good night.
Good evening. Yeah.
Or bon matin, like good morning.
Bon après-midi.
Ah.
Good afternoon.
Nice.
Yep. I'm getting.
We're little babies.
Really, this is all I learned.
We should practice
from this
together.
Hour. We should.
Okay.
I need practice desperately.
Me too.
Yeah.
Have you learned how to introduce yourself?
Not yet.
Yeah.
That's coming.
Alyssa's doing it. I don't, if, you know, if you end up seeing the show at some point, she's introducing herself in Michif. She's taking courses. And so I'm going to try to, like, get in on those materials. But, yeah, it's cool. And it reminds me actually of some Anishinaabe Mohan that I've learned.
The incomparable Amanda Rayom. What a joy to see her again and to just take in her pride at sharing Métis stories through song. Such a beautiful antidote to the label the Métis are often given, the forgotten people. A powerful act of resistance. Next time on Words and Culture, the Michif episodes, I'll speak with a Michif textile artist who has created a project to make sure that Métis matriarchs are not forgotten. She gathered groups together to stitch, bead, and quill the names of grandmothers, mothers, aunties, daughters, sisters, cousins, and friends onto textile pieces, which were then stitched onto a long, long piece of red broadcloth symbolizing the Red River. She not only created a stunning work of art, she built community, one stitch at a time. Tracy Charette Fair is my guest next week on Words and Culture. I'm Sheila Rogers. Kawapamatin Mina. See you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Numaltis.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
This is Bird Note. Puffins are boldly colorful icons of northern islands and sea cliffs, where they nest in dense colonies during the summer. In the spring, puffins grow thin, blazingly colorful layers over the base of their huge beaks. Some species' beaks turn vivid yellow, others a bright red or orange, and they make all kinds of noise. In winter, however, puffins lead very different lives. For one thing, winter puffins are not nearly as fancy. Once their chicks fledge in late summer, adult puffins shed the ornaments that wowed their mates in spring. Their beaks turn a dull orange, and their bright white summer faces turn a sooty color. Tufted puffins, named for their long blonde head tufts, go tuftless in winter. Horned puffins lose the fleshy horns above their eyes. And puffins in winter go silent as well. The birds depart their nesting cliffs by September and head for the open ocean. Three species winter in the North Pacific, and one in the North Atlantic. Puffins remain largely solitary for the 7 months of the year they spend at sea. But as winter gives way to spring, the clowns of the cliffs return, once again outfitted.